Joining me today is Brenda Elliott, co-author of The Manchurian President, Barack Obama's Ties to Communists, Socialists, and Other Anti-American Extremists. Thanks for joining us today, Brenda.
Thank you for having me.
Brenda, it's a great book. I just want to start with a term that many folks might not be too familiar with, blogging. Blogging had a lot to do with this book, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Blogging, for a lot of people, they may remember hearing about it. People started out blogging by basically doing personal diaries or personal memoirs, writing online. The format was available to anyone, and then it kind of grew. There are still a lot of personal family blogs out there, but then it grew. And it now has gone into the political arena, where we have blogs that run on internet websites of the Washington Post or the New York Times or other online publications. And then you have political bloggers that run independent blogs, like I do. Mine is on WordPress. A lot of people use Blogspot. They're both free.
Right.
And almost anybody can sign up and go in and start doing a blog.
And blog, I guess, is short for weblog. Is that right?
Yes, it's a web log, like somebody would keep a log book.
Right.
My blog, The Real Barack Obama, or is known as RBO, RBO became kind of a place to be for following all things Barack Obama right before the Democratic Convention in Denver in summer of 2008.
Right. So really, the Manchurian President, as I said before, would not exist if it weren't for bloggers.
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, my blog and then people like that I connect with, John Batchelor, WABC Radio, he has a blog and I cross-post a lot of his articles. Blogging is how I met Aaron Klein. When I started blogging, the first blog I had called Resco Watch to follow the Tony Resco trial, Aaron Klein and I crossed paths, virtually speaking, because of my blog about the Resco trial, as I did with John Batchelor and as I did also with someone else that Aaron and I quote in the book, Trevor Loudon, who is a blogger in New Zealand who documents socialist, communist, Marxist, etc. around the world.
And Aaron Klein, of course, is the co-author of the book. And it's just incredible how people who might not have even met or may never meet are coordinating to put together such a project. The book reads like a legal document. It has, I believe, almost 1,000 footnotes. Isn't that right?
893, if we want to be precise.
Yes, we do.
And it's important. It's not a fluff piece. It is a historical document. To our knowledge, Aaron and I, we've not received any emails. We've not received any challenges about anything we speak that is factual. People may not like what we had to say, but we can assure readers that it is a factual document.
Right. The title's very provocative, The Manchurian President. Of course, it gets a name from the book and the movies, The Manchurian Candidate. I want to touch upon the success of the book. When did it come out?
It actually was listed on Amazon on April 20th. It officially was released on May the 3rd. That was the Monday after the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That date is significant because WorldNet Daily has an article on their website. Aaron Klein was supposed to release the book May the 1st at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and that did not happen because WorldNet Daily did not get the number of seats at the table that they had requested, and pretty much got frozen out at that point at the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So the release was made on May the 3rd on Monday. Aaron released it on radio, on Michael Savage's radio show, and then the following night on Fox News on Sean Hannity's show.
And how was it received?
The White House Correspondents' Dinner is a pretty good indication that either the book or WorldNet Daily wasn't well received at the dinner. And from then on, it's not been a wide arms, a huggy kissy kind of relationship with the mainstream media.
Now, how about the public, though? How did the public receive the book?
Well, apparently the public likes it. 50% approximately of the public voted for Barack Obama. The other 50% did not. And we guesstimate that by the rapid sales, because the book was literally sold out at Amazon within a couple of days, and Amazon was reporting 1 to 4 months for people to receive a copy, the publisher had to work really hard to get enough books out there in the pipe, because it takes time from being printed to being delivered, et cetera,
right,
through the distributors. So There was a time lag. It sold out initially. It was very difficult to keep up with the orders for the first couple of weeks at least. It soared on the Amazon list. We were number 4 and number 5 bestseller the first week. It made its way up to number 10, a hardback nonfiction on the New York Times bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
It made its way to Publishers Weekly, number 14, back the 1st of June. And then Washington Post has a summer reading list of flame-throwing books,
right.
And Manchurian made the cut on that summer reading list. So I would say, in general, it had a great reception from the public because all of those statistics are based on sales.
Right. Wow. And this is all without really any reviews from the mainstream media, except for, as you mentioned earlier, the Washington Times.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Washington Times, other people have mentioned it. Howard Kurtz did mention it in a review. We've had, of course, Fox News has been very good in that. Aaron did the initial release on Hannity's show.
Right.
Of course, Aaron appears on Fox News, on the business news, quite often.
Mm-hmm.
So he has been on several times with that. Radio, Aaron has done the major radio because these are people he's interviewed with before. And I've done, I'm guessing now, probably close to 200 radio interviews since the end of April.
Wow.
And I'm still getting calls to do more interviews. And usually by this time, this many weeks, unless you have a publisher that sends you on a media tour around the country, what I hear is that they don't stay alive like this quite this long.
Right. It has legs. Now, your publicist, who contacted, as publicists do, various outlets, Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine, the New York Times, and so on and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that process. What happened? She sent something out to them to let them know about the book?
Well, she sent out a press release. If you have a new book coming out, normally you would let all the people on your media list know a book is coming out, and you would do the courtesy of saying, would you like a review copy? I mean, nothing alarming about that whatsoever, but
right.
What was quite surprising was the response, and from mainstream people who said horrible things. And I
right.
think you've got
right, I do.
A copy of some of those there. And please,
I do.
Please share.
Yes,
please
thank
share.
Yes, I really want to, because this is amazing. Now, this is simply from the publicist contacting the New York Daily News, Time Magazine, and so on and so forth, and saying, we have this book. Would you like a review copy to read it? Just to read it. Would you like it?
Exactly.
New York Daily News said, and this is in emails that were received by Maria Sliwa, the publicist. Ridiculous crap from the New York Daily News. Never, ever contact me again from Time Magazine senior writer. This is sensational rubbish that is of no interest to any legitimate publication. That was from Newsweek deputy editor. Now, let me read a few more, if I may. Absolute crap from a Huffington Post contributor who served for 17 years as United Nations Bureau Chief for Reuters. Remove me from your list. Nancy Gibbs, editor-at-large for Newsweek. Seriously, get a life. The fella from AOL, America Online, their political writer. And I think there's one more here. So offensive and so far afield by the publicity director for The Nation. The most amazing thing about these comments, Brenda, is that, as you say here, the reporters rejected the thoroughly documented book before receiving review copies of the title. So essentially, they said this without even reading it. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, here you have an email that comes in, on the as you would get any other time, and you see, how would you like to see our book? And all they had to do, apparently, was to look at the title, and they suddenly decided that this was not only not worth their time, because normally they would either gracefully decline or just not even answer. But this went out, and by May the 5th, now this is 2 days after the book is officially released, within 2 days, this flood of vitriol showed up in Maria's inbox. I mean, it's bizarre.
Now, had Maria, did she say if she'd ever seen anything like this before?
Never before.
And what do you...
Never before.
Why do you think it happened like that?
Well, I don't want to get into conspiracy theory territory here, but to get that many responses of this tenor,
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, this vitriol.
Yes.
From nothing more than an email. Sounds like a whole bunch of people had a spontaneous reaction and came up with basically the same response. I mean, you would have to kind of think that somebody talked to somebody and they said, hey, let's do this. I mean, it's crazy.
I mean, like you said, you don't want to get into the conspiracies, but a lot of times that's the way it works, because if a person who's been a publicist for many years in this business has never seen anything like this, then the odds of something like this happening are almost impossible, and that perhaps there was somebody or something that contacted all of these news organizations and told them to reply in that fashion. Of course, the mainstream media is controlled by just really a few companies and a few individuals, so perhaps it's not so much a conspiracy. What do you think?
Well, of all those people on the list, the only one that I might expect that kind of a response from would be The Nation. The Nation is closely affiliated with the Institute for Policy Studies, which is very closely related to Democratic Society folks that are connected to the Socialist International. There's a very direct line that connects all of those people together. And The Nation, yeah, I would expect that. From Newsweek, no, I wouldn't expect that.
Hmm. You know, in the introduction of the book, the first page, actually, where you say in early 2008, the Democratic presidential primary campaign was getting into full swing. Increasingly, it was becoming clear that a little-known contender, Illinois junior Senator Barack Obama, was positioned to upset the well-financed and popular candidacy of Hillary Clinton for the nomination. Major questions immediately loomed large about this young senator. What were his background and personal history? What were his politics? And who and what had shaped his views? What was his record as a politician? And what was he promising to do as president? All of these critical issues are usually raised as a matter of course when anyone, particularly someone new and virtually unknown, runs for a major political office, especially the presidency of the United States, the most powerful of all political offices. And yet, astonishingly, none of our watchdogs in the news media seem to care. Of course, you say with the exception of Fox News, talk radio, and some blogs and online news venues. But how could it be, Brenda, that the entire, if it's not a conspiracy, then how can you explain that virtually the entire mainstream media news organ ignored that?
Well, I think that it's exactly because that they did, for whatever their motives are, we don't know. But I think that's exactly why the blogosphere, as in general as the bloggers are known, I think that's why the blogosphere dug as deeply, and they're still digging as deeply. And it's not just the people who write the blogs. Some of them are cooperative blogs. So you may have 2, 3, or even 10 different writers.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody dug like crazy out there. And then most of us have a comment section on our blog, so it's interactive. If I write an article today, people can come and read it, and they can make comments. Now, if it's nasty stuff or language they shouldn't use, then, you know, most of us just moderate that away and make it go away. But for the most part, we get very helpful information. We get tips. I'm very grateful for those tips because a lot of them led me to find some very significant stuff. And those commenters are out there also digging. They don't want to do a blog, but they do want to dig and find information, and then they forward that information. So the blogosphere is much bigger than just the writers. It also includes the commenters, who are very key to making it real and keeping us honest.
Right.
All of these people were working furiously. I mean, people not sleeping around the clock almost, because all these issues kept them awake and interested and determined to find answers. And the more everyone dug, the more we realized we just didn't know. And unfortunately, we can still sit here today and say there's a lot we just don't know.
On the next page of the introduction, much of Obama's already known past, as well as that of some of his closest associates, was remarkably radical for so prominent a politician. Still, the news media remained mysteriously uninterested. Future historians will have to grapple with the fantastic phenomenon of the U.S. news media's having, as a class, almost completely abdicated their traditional responsibility when it came to investigating the background of the unknown politician running for the country's highest office. I mean, if that's not a conspiracy, I don't know what is.
Well, they're definitely, you know, if they are not around, if these are older people, they may not be around to be assessed. But I think definitely their children and their grandchildren will. And it's they're not going to come out of this looking very good. You know, as a historian, I just can't see how the media can just ignore a candidate in his whole past and just blink and walk by, okay, we don't know these things, but that's okay. I just don't see how they can do that. I've never heard of anything. As a historian, I rely on the historical record to make sense of things. And that whole piece is going to be a great big question mark, I think, in history books of the future.
On page 11 in the introduction, the many issues pertaining to Obama's eligibility to be president, the raising of which are not only utterly ignored, but routinely ridiculed in the establishment press. So not only do they ignore it, but when somebody wants to bring it up, they ridicule you. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the terms that I've been asked this, are you a birther? If you're a birther, if you ask questions about where, think of any history book you've ever read, and you have the person's name, his dates of birth, and if he's passed on, his date of his death,
right,
where he was born, where he went to school. We read about people like Abraham Lincoln and what kind of a student he was and so on and so forth. Lots of details. We have someone who is going to be groundbreaking as a president, the first black president, the first multicultural president, I mean, from the African American and the Caucasian, the white community. And this is a very unique individual, and people wanted to know everything. Yet every door to very basic things like how did he do in college? What courses did he take? You know, did he write any papers? And on and on and on. I mean, almost anything you can think of. And the door is closed on that. The information apparently is in a lockbox that somebody has a magic formula, and someday maybe it's going to be like one of those puzzles that $1 million, if you can solve it, maybe someday that's how we're going to figure this all out. There's going to be some fantastic prize out there.
Right.
But in fact, you know, there actually is. Perhaps you have talked with or you know about Wayne Allen Root of the Libertarian Party. In 1983, he graduated from Columbia the same year that Barack Obama graduated. He would have attended the same classes because they both had the same major, political science. They probably would have had the same professors, probably some of the same assignments,
sure,
and so forth. But Wayne Allen Root can't find anyone, himself included, that met Barack Obama. He doesn't know anybody that attended classes with him that knew Barack Obama. And the last that I knew, there's $1 million on the table from Wayne Allen Root to prove that Barack Obama was at Columbia and took those classes.
On page 18, exactly what you're talking about, no official or unofficial records were ever made available from Columbia University. No college transcripts, published records, or even contemporary newspaper announcements about his education have ever been released. And then you say, we get back to the mainstream media, it speaks volumes about the irresponsibility of the mainstream news media when it comes to covering Obama, that a serious investigation has never been launched until now, nor a major furor raised in response to Obama's continuing refusal to provide standard biographical data. Yes, I did hear about him, because didn't he interview over 400 people and not one of them knew who he was?
Exactly. Aaron has interviewed him. I think Aaron also has an article at WorldNet Daily, probably a couple of years ago now, or close to that, that he wrote. And I've seen Mr. Root on, I believe, on Fox News at one time last year, within the past year, talking about it. And I've not seen anywhere that this information has come forward, so I'm guessing that $1 million is still out there waiting for somebody.
I guess he was absent the day they were taking the photographs for the yearbook then.
So he was present. That's how you're there, but you're not really there. You vote present. Apparently, he was absent every time they took a roll call for anything, because nobody seems to remember him.
As you close out your chapter, you say from 1981 to 1983, the president of the United States was essentially the invisible man, and the mainstream media just doesn't seem to care, do they?
Maybe that's what we should have used for the title, The Invisible Man. It might have got a better review by the mainstream media.
Oh boy. I mean, there's so much that can be said about the mainstream media. It literally would take one interview just to talk about them. His transcripts, his eligibility, as you said, is he eligible to be the president? Is he a natural born citizen? And although, as you point out in the book, there's some debate about the actual term of natural born because the writers of the Constitution really didn't define it, but there still are questions about whether or not he's eligible. And have there been any government investigations or hearings about this topic?
Not one, but you know, I think that we did allude to this, and we didn't go into great detail. And now that we're going to have a 2012 election coming up, if he decides to run, you know that there are 50 people in this country that have the right to ask for proof of eligibility, and those are the secretaries of state. They're the ones that receive the applications to be placed on each state ballot. So there are some people out there that have the authority. There's been a lot of lawsuits, you know, and one of the problems is cases have been thrown out because people don't have standing. Someone filing a lawsuit, in order for it not to be a frivolous lawsuit, they have to have a legitimate reason for filing that lawsuit, and that's called standing. The secretaries of state of the 50 states, each one of those people have a standing. So, you know, we'll see if anybody wants to play chicken come the filings for 2012.
And this is hilarious on page 77, where you say, despite the many questions left unanswered, no official government body has ever investigated these issues. Amazingly, one Republican lawmaker, Senator John Kyle of Arizona, when questioned by constituents about birth certificate issues, cited a website, Snopes.com, as conclusively laying these issues to rest. I mean, come on, are we on another planet?
Apparently. I do know that Snopes debunks a lot of things. But you know what source the Obama campaign used is they had a website to address all of these challenges or these conspiracies, and they consistently cite their own website for being the source of debunking. Well, that's like asking the burglar, did you hide the money? And they go, well, just go to my website. I spell it all out there. You don't have to worry about it.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up about Snopes, because I rely on Snopes a lot to debunk things. Not taking anything away from Snopes, but just the fact that Kyle referred constituents to that website to answer these questions. It just seems ludicrous. I don't get it. Now, let's get into the nuts and bolts of this book. It started, I guess, with Obama's history as a community organizer and following the tenets of a fellow by the name of Saul Alinsky. And this fellow Alinsky, I think he passed on, but he plays prominently in Obama's rise to the presidency, doesn't he?
Well, he does, because in any kind of a tradition, there's always someone who was the leader or the guy who thought of it first, you know, the inventor. Saul Alinsky comes out of the 1940s. I don't know if he would have called himself a community organizer, but what he created is basically the backbone for community organizing. And to boil it down to very simple terms, you identify a problem, you identify an issue, and then you go and find people who would be concerned about that issue, and you rally them around that issue, and you can get them to protest, you can get them to go, you know, door to door, getting support, many different things to rally around that issue. But as David Horowitz, who was with the Students for Democratic Society and is well known to have been a radical who has gone to the conservative side of things since,
mm-hmm.
They call it, this is a Marxist term, of course, they call it boring from within.
Right.
And what you do is you take the issue and you go within to push for it. To Alinsky's techniques, we add the Cloward-Piven strategy, which comes out of the 60s. It's an extension on that idea of Richard Cloward, who is now passed on, and his wife, Frances Fox Piven, who is still very active in the progressive Marxist community.
Mm-hmm.
And that what they believe is not only do you bore from within, but that you overwhelm the system. You take these issues and these activists, and you overwhelm the system to make change happen. And they almost succeeded in the 1970s in collapsing New York City with welfare claims. So it is an effective strategy. Now, Barack Obama leaves Columbia about 1983. He becomes involved with a couple of jobs in New York City, one of them being the New York PIRG, which is an activist organization that was founded by Ralph Nader. Many people are familiar with Ralph Nader from banning the Corvair.
Unsafe at any speed.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And Ralph Nader is still politically active, and he ran for president a few times. But Barack Obama became involved in 1983-84 in New York with the PIRG. And then he answers an ad and goes to Chicago to work for an organization called the Developing Communities Project. He actually becomes the first head of that. It was a project of the Gamaliel Foundation, which identifies itself as a church-based organization. Really what they do is community activism, and the groups that they use to work with are church groups. And these people at the Gamaliel Foundation are the people who are disciples and followers of the Saul Alinsky techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So when Obama gets to Chicago, not only does he go to work for these people who train him in the Saul Alinsky techniques of agitation and community organizing, but Barack Obama becomes so good at it that he also teaches it for them. And one of the groups that we know that he taught these community activist techniques to is ACORN. And ACORN has been in the news pretty much for the past 2 years anyhow.
Right.
Obama, in turn, has a long-term relationship with ACORN. So Saul Alinsky goes from this founder to passing on his techniques and his beliefs, and then Barack Obama becomes the inheritor and the person who passes them on to other generations, literally.
So they're boring from within to destroy the system or to...
Work within the system to destroy the system.
You alluded to New York City. Didn't they go bankrupt? And that was from what, welfare?
They came very close because of this overwhelming of the welfare system.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes right straight, you know, it's a straight line from Saul Alinsky's techniques, added to it the Cloward-Piven strategy, as it's called,
right,
which really is an extension of the Alinsky techniques.
Right. The groups, the entities, the individuals behind Barack Obama, the community organizer, not counting Barack Obama now, but we can because they're still there, as I learned from reading your fine book, those people, those entities, those groups, they were in the left camps, in Marxist and communist camps, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, and out of the 60s. Remember on the campaign trail, Barack Obama made mention in a couple of speeches, you know, the 60s were all behind us, you know.
Right.
That was all in the 60s, you know, referring to Bill Ayers, but not just Bill Ayers and some of those radicals that he had crossed paths with, but the whole idea of the 60s. Which is absolutely ludicrous because all of these different groups have their origins with the 60s. Sociology being taught in the colleges then was basically Marxist. And all of those young people who were in college in the 60s, that was what they were being taught. That was what they learned. And many of them, not all of them, of course, but many of them have carried on since then with that same those same beliefs, that same philosophy. And we have them in all of these different think tanks. All of that body of work has boiled down through the 60s to the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and a lot of it, a great majority of it really, because it's the same thing boiled over and over and over, has shown up in legislation. We have the Obamacare legislation that was written by Health Care for America Now, which is the most recent group. It's just another name for the same people. We have the stimulus that was written to a large degree by the Apollo Alliance, which again includes many of the same people. Robert L. Borosage, for one, Joel Rogers is another name. We have these same groups who have literally had waiting on the table 1,000 or 2,000 pages of these massive bills that were immediately ushered into Congress and voted in, and now we're stuck with them. But these are products of these Marxist teachers, professors at colleges for the 60s radicals who now are respectable and wearing suits and ties and writing legislation.
The fellow you mentioned earlier, Bill Ayers, tell our listeners a little bit about him. It's pretty amazing.
Yes, Bill Ayers graduated from college and was a teacher for a time, but then he got caught up in the Students for a Democratic Society organization. It started out with them mostly being concerned with studying how to make the future better, but that didn't last real long. They started doing demonstrations on college campuses. People probably will remember either knowing about or hearing about anti-war rallies. I mean, that was one of the types of things that they were involved with. Bill Ayers, at that time, wasn't a leader. The person that people may have heard of is Tom Hayden. He wrote the manifesto for SDS, as they were known. Bill Ayers and his now wife, Bernadine Dorn, at the end of 1969, we're a few years into SDS being in existence, and there was a group within SDS who were not happy with just demonstrating. Things weren't happening fast enough. Things weren't going the way that they wanted. We were still in Vietnam, and they were very much for getting out of Vietnam. And they split with Bernadine Dorn, really was the leader. Bill Ayers, Mark Rudd, and Jeff Jones led the revolt of where a number of people walked out on SDS, and they formed another group called Weather. People may remember them more as the Weather Underground, but they weren't the Underground until they did not show up at court for charges from the 1968, the Democratic National Convention riots, as well as the Days of Rage, which were in 1969, where they just terrorized downtown Chicago.
Right.
They didn't show up for those hearings and went underground. And then after that, Bill Ayers and Dorn and many of the others got involved in bombing. And a couple of the places they tried to bomb was the Department of State and the Pentagon and other government buildings. Not nice people.
No.
And they are today still unrepentant. They have no remorse. For that matter, Bill Ayers, in an infamous interview that was published in the New York Times on 9/11, even though he had actually given the interview prior to that, he said in that interview, We should have done more. We didn't really do enough.
So they actually did bomb the Pentagon and the State Department.
Yes, okay. They did.
Did they kill anybody?
No, they say that nobody died. Diana Auten was one of the SDS people. She and Ted Gould and the third person, I can't remember the name.
Mm-hmm.
The three of them were killed in New York City in a brownstone next door to Dustin Hoffman, as it turns out.
Wow.
They made a mistake, and the bomb accidentally detonated and killed the three of them.
Right.
So people did die, but not as far as we know in those particular bombings.
Wow. And this was the fellow where Obama, I believe, launched his state senatorial campaign from Bill Ayers' house. Is that right?
Yes. Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers are people who just happen to live in Barack Obama's neighborhood.
Right.
In 1995, Barack Obama was like an aide to Alice Palmer, who was in the Illinois State Senate. And Palmer decided that she wanted to run for Congress. So she pretty much put her political protege, Barack Obama, up for her seat. And that announcement was made in Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn's living room. Now, besides Palmer saying that that happened, there was another person, Quentin D. Young, who is an MD.
Mm-hmm.
He is the number one proponent of single-payer health care in the U.S. He just also happens to be a Barack Obama neighbor and friend.
Right.
And Quentin Young told the Politico that he was there, too, and yes, that happened. And there are other people who have stepped forward and said, yes, that did happen at Bill Ayers' house. So no matter what Barack Obama wants to say, there are people who know him and know him well who were witnesses and have stepped up and said, yep, that happened.
Hmm. And as you point out in your book, Obama was clearly involved in the Socialist Party. And as we said earlier, there's, what was it, 863 or 836, something like that?
893.
I was close. 893 footnotes from this book. And he has ties to the Nation of Islam and Black Radicals, and of course to ACORN that everybody's heard so much about. And of course to labor unions. And what was fascinating about that, why do the Democrats have such an affinity for labor? And as you say here on page 131, the AFL-CIO has always delivered votes to the Democratic Party so that the Democratic Party would deliver public sector jobs and dues income labor bureaucracy. The head of one of the most involved unions in the election of Barack Obama to president, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, was headed by a fellow by the name of Andy Stern. Is that right?
Yes, and Andy Stern, as it just so happens, was another member of Students for a Democratic Society in the 60s. There is a common thread here.
Sure, right, exactly.
It keeps coming up.
That is the book right there. The book is the common thread between all of these individuals and all of these entities. The common thread is that they are leaning towards Marxism and socialism, and they took Barack Obama and elevated him to the position he's at now. That is the book, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And Barack Obama, his first campaign in 1995, some of the first funds that he received was from the local SEIU people. There were other unions locally that did as well, but SEIU has been with Barack Obama since day one, practically. I believe it was in 2007 at a gathering of activists, I think they call it the Heartland Forum. Barack Obama was on the stage, and he made the statement that he has been with SEIU his whole career. He's made
right.
a similar statement about ACORN, that he has been with ACORN his whole career. ACORN and SEIU are connected. I believe that you'll find in the book that at one time, if you looked up the address for ACORN in Chicago, you would find the address for SEIU. They shared the same offices and they shared the same people, coincidence, not. These two organizations have carried him along with votes, of course, because people that are members go out to vote. But more importantly, they go out knocking on doors and doing voter registration and getting people to come vote. There is a very close relationship there that just cannot be denied. I mean, the Illinois voter records with the state show who the funders and supporters were. And it's right there in black and white. They have been financially connected for a very long time.
And you and your co-author successfully brought all this information out. It's amazing. And that's why there are so many footnotes. Now, Andy Stern, who did it, I guess, until recently, head the SEIU, he was at one point, and you mentioned this in your book, a frequent visitor to the White House, to Barack Obama's White House. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is. He's not the only member, of course, of unions that has had Richard Trumka, who is AFL-CIO, has had he's a frequent flyer at the White House as well, but not as much as Andy Stern. Andy Stern now, of course, has stepped down, but we write in the book about his aspirations for taking SEIU and the union movement globally.
Right.
And I think that's where he's gone. I think that eventually we're going to see him pop up a lot more. There are conspiracy theorists who think that Barack Obama won't be happy to be emperor of the United States. He's going to want to be king of the world. And if SEIU has anything to do with it, that quite possibly could happen.
So Stern might be preparing the ground for that, as Stern and his allies prepared the ground for Barack Obama to go into the White House. Wasn't Stern the most frequent visitor to the White House?
Most frequent flyer, yes, absolutely. And also keep in mind, if Stern is out there taking SEIU international or global, that money, those dues are going to flow back to the mothership, so to speak. So, you know, it's beneficial to be out there fundraising with union members international. And ACORN has taken their operation international as well. I wrote about that actually today on my blog, RBO.
What is that blog address? Tell our listeners that blog address in case they want to come and...
Okay.
Go ahead.
TheRealBarackObama.wordpress.com, and it's known as RBO. I wrote an article today about Mexico because there was an article about the Mexican election that just happened, that mm-hmm. presidential election ballots were found in the dumpster, literally. And somebody wondered if ACORN had gone international and set up in Mexico. And the answer is yes. I wrote about this
wow.
more than a year ago, back in March of 2009, that ACORN had gone international. They, even though on the website they still say ACORN International, they have a new name, Community Organizations International. Same organization, same logo, same everything.
Mm-hmm.
ACORN, you know, nationally has done the same thing. They are no longer ACORN, a national organization. They have splintered off, you know, like little legs off a centipede, and now we have individual state organizations with different non-ACORN names. That's just so that you won't notice that they still have the same address and the same people.
Pretty smart. So they're getting ready for maybe a new world government, a new world order, setting the global stage for, like you said, Barack Obama as king of the world.
Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people that, and it's not just tongue-in-cheek, there are a lot of people that do think that the idea is to go nationally, and of course some people refer to it as Obama International Apology Tour, but some of those countries out there that he has apologized to do appear in Acorn International, and one of them, believe it or not, is Kenya. Kenya now has an Acorn branch. Makes you wonder.
Yeah, a little. All of these folks coming from similar backgrounds. One of the most fascinating is the story about that fella Jones. And you guys broke that, didn't you? Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Well, the Van Jones story kind of has a history. We have to give Trevor Loudon first credit on this.
Okay.
He is a blogger from New Zealand. Trevor created what he calls the Obama Files. And one of the Obama Files that he did in April of last year was about Van Jones. He had tripped over some information about Van Jones. Well, I have been cross-posting Trevor's articles for a very long time, and we toss things back and forth. He sends me something, and I post it, I amplify on it. I send him something, and he goes digging and comes up with more information on his side.
Right.
So we've had a very good symbiotic relationship here. I do one thing, and then he does the other.
Right.
So he came out with the first post on Van Jones around the first few days of April. I think the 6th, something like the 6th. So I posted that, I took some more information, and I went digging. And then I posted a couple more articles, and then Aaron Klein, my co-author, went digging. And then this went on now for several weeks. Like all bloggers, as I mentioned, we have people who send us tips, who send us information.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lady that has been very, very helpful. She goes by Beethoven Queen. She's anonymous on the blog, of course.
Right.
She was very helpful. I was digging up video clips, and I was sending her the video clips while she was doing other things. She's listening to them and writing down notes. So in effect, she's transcribing them. I was doing some transcribing of some other video clips. And then between she and I, we were both feeding this to Aaron, and Aaron was writing articles furiously.
Right.
So we were just flooding with, and of course, Trevor hadn't given up either. Trevor was doing more of his own digging. So between Beethoven Queen, who was anonymous, and myself and Aaron and Trevor, I mean, we just dumped a mountain of information about Van Jones out there. I mean, it became so overwhelming with all of these clips and the things that he was saying and the background that
Right, who is he? Who is this guy? Who was he? I mean, he's still around.
Very much around.
Yeah, but he was in the Obama administration, wasn't he? He was some kind of czar?
Yes, he was the green job czar. Van Jones in the early 1990s, he has, of course, a history before this, but in the early 1990s, he is the leader of this Marxist-Leninist organization called STORM. And they had a booklet that they published at the end of 1994. Everything that they had planned to do didn't work out. So basically, this booklet is an analysis of what worked and what did not work. But what comes out very clearly is they were all for overthrowing the American government. They're anti-capitalists. They are Marxists. No question about it. And Van Jones identifies himself as a small C communist. Now, the difference between a small C communist and a big C communist is the people who are small C's really never become members.
Okay.
So they're fellow travelers, as the Marxists like to say.
Right.
They go along with all the things of the communist beliefs and whatever, but they never really get the card. They never really start to be card carriers. So this was Van Jones at the end of the about 1994. Next thing we know, Van Jones resurfaces. He's found a new cause. He's gone from books for prisons and, you know, turn the prisoners out of the jails in California. He goes from that, he discovers the global warming movement. He discovers climate change. This is the new gig.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets very involved with the climate change people and becomes a member of the Apollo Alliance, which is what I had mentioned earlier. They are the people that wrote the stimulus bill. They basically helped draft the cap and trade bill. So Van Jones ends up being one of the people with the Apollo Alliance, and then Barack Obama becomes president, and the next thing we know, one of the multitude of czars, we have Van Jones.
And he's not the green job czar anymore, is he?
No, he slunk away on a Saturday night. You know, word is on one side, of course, that he resigned. On the other side, obviously, he went under the Obama bus, which means he was fired.
Right.
He's gone. He is gone from the White House, I should say, because he is not gone. He fell quite hard with a job at Princeton teaching, and he also fell with the Center for American Progress, which is a John Podesta organization that is funded by George Soros.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and of course, getting back to the mainstream media, on page 154 of your book, the mainstream media predictably ignored the Jones revelations right up until the moment of his resignation on September 5th, 2009. They did it again, didn't they, Brenda?
Yes, they did. And you know what? I still have to say, on top of everything that Trevor wrote and I wrote and Aaron wrote, Glenn Beck played night after night after night after night the clips from the Van Jones videotapes.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the mainstream media would not acknowledge all of this, it could not be ignored because it had reached critical mass. I mean, something had to happen.
It's shocking. This stuff is just, it's shocking that the mainstream media, with the exception of Glenn Beck, the mainstream media just, what do they do? I mean, I don't understand. What are they there for? If they're not going to be real reporters, why are they there?
It's a good question. And, you know, talking about the media, Fox News, you have to give them credit. Glenn Beck has played the videotapes and commented. He has talked on his radio, I know. Sean Hannity was the first, I believe, that found Jeremiah Wright. He started talking about Jeremiah Wright back in 2007.
That's Obama's
preacher,
right?
Before anybody else paid attention. Before anybody else paid attention. And nobody wanted to pay attention to what Hannity was saying until Wright became an issue, of course, in the spring of 2008 during the campaign. The mainstream media has just, the three monkeys, see no, hear no, you know, it's mm-hmm. they just don't want to acknowledge that all of this is true. And, of course, another example is Anita Dunn. Anita Dunn was part of the messaging at the Obama White House, and she had been involved with the Obama campaign. And Glenn Beck is the one who showed the video of her saying that Chairman Mao was one of her favorite philosophers. And mainstream media didn't want to pay any attention to that. And then my assistant, my trusty assistant, Beethoven Queen, discovered a video of Dunn talking, I believe it was in Puerto Rico or the Philippines, I'm not sure, I can't remember exactly where she was, talking about how that she, for the Obama campaign, that they had decided what information would be given to the mainstream media. Not that the media would ask any questions, not that they would do any investigation, but they would control the message so that the media would deliver the message to the public that they, the Obama campaign, wanted delivered. Well, Beethoven Queen transcribed that. I tidied up all the notes and everything, fired it off to Aaron. That article came out at midnight on a Sunday night, and by Monday, it was all over the conservative talk radio. It was on Sean Hannity. It was on Glenn Beck.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Beck showed it on his TV show that night. And the next thing we know, Anita Dunn was gone.
So it seems like
the mainstream media do anything about any of this.
You guys do all the work.
Apparently.
And then if they want, then they'll pick up some of the work that you did. If they don't want to pick it up, then they'll tell you you're crazy. Don't ever communicate with me again. I don't ever want to see you again. Get that stuff out of my face.
Yeah.
Because they can. Or they're arrogant, aren't they, Brenda?
Well, absolutely. You know, and this has been going on for a long time. I've never told very many people this, but way back in the spring of 2008, when I started Resco Watch, it was quite humorous. The late Bob Novak, someone from his staff, left a comment on the Resco Watch blog. He wanted to interview me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was quite happy being anonymous. I also was using a variation on my maiden name at that time before I went totally anonymous, because after that I decided I really got to go anonymous here. And I just ignored it. I didn't want to interview because I didn't want what I do to be about me. I wanted it to be about the work and the message that it carried. But I will give Bob Novak credit. He did try to find out who I was, find out what I was doing. And then he included that in an article. He just misnamed me. And like everybody else, until I came out of the closet, they all assumed I was a male.
Right. Sure.
And I think that burst the bubble big time. Because all of the big-time bloggers, you know, with an exception of a few, but the majority of the big-time bloggers, the political bloggers, are all men.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Rezco Watch. Of course, that's that fellow Tony Rezco. What's his significance in all this?
Well, Tony, you know, Bill Ayers just happened to live in the neighborhood. Tony Rezco's wife just happened to buy a piece of land right next to the faux mansion that Barack and Michelle Obama bought in 2005 in Chicago. They just happen to be neighbors. Tony Rezco is a equal opportunity political, I don't know what kind of word I would use for him. I wouldn't use the word leech, but definitely a
parasite.
Parasite, there you go.
Yeah.
Tony Rezco was equal opportunity, you know, Republican governors of Illinois, Democratic candidate. It didn't matter. You know, he would go and raise money for either one.
Right.
He was a developer and a realtor. So a lot of his contacts were in the contracting business or the real estate financing business. And that's where he went and got money to help back his various candidates. Well, right now, you know, we have the Rod Blagojevich trial going on in Chicago, and Rezco's name has come back up again. Tony Rezco just so happened to raise a lot of money for Barack Obama, beginning with his Illinois State Senate campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, Rezco, I think, first three contributions to Obama's 1995 run for the Illinois State Senate came from Tony Rezco or his businesses directly. No hiding that money, no hiding that original connection whatsoever. But of course, the real estate deal from 2005 is what really raised eyebrows, at least with the Chicago media. I don't think it made its way outside of Chicago too much. And of course, those were my sources when I started Rezco Watch, were all of these Chicago newspaper articles, as well as some Chicago bloggers, because there are some excellent Chicago bloggers who know everything about the Chicago way that you'd ever want to know.
Right, the Chicago scene. It seems like this guy Rezco was probably the only guy involved who wasn't a communist.
You'd have to go to the Rezco Watch and do a lot of reading. There's probably 1,000 or more articles there before I transitioned to RBO, the real Barack Obama, in June of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
The trial ended. Rezco was found guilty of about 16 corruption charges. He is carefully hidden away somewhere for safekeeping. Nobody seems to know right where he is. He has never been sentenced. The rumors were that he was singing like a canary. I wrote several articles about Rezco's singing and what he might be saying.
Right.
But he's among the missing. Although his name has been brought up now, again, in Blagojevich's trial, just recently made the remark himself that he's getting hung with Tony Rezco when Barack Obama has a big, heavier load of Rezco around his neck. So Rezco is gone. He's out of sight, but definitely not out of mind.
Bunch of shady characters there. Chapter 14, the healthcare. Healthcare for America Now, HCAN. What can you tell our listeners about that?
Well, HCAN, here we go again.
Mm-hmm.
HCAN, of course, has all of its own associations with all of the same shady characters, so to speak. There are the same people over and over. The word they like to use is coalition. They have lots of coalitions.
Right.
And members of the HCAN coalition include ACORN, SEIU, Apollo Alliance.
The usual suspects.
The usual suspects over and over and over again.
Right. And you guys connected the dots to all this.
Yes, we did.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Continue with HCAN.
No, that's fine. I mean, it's absolutely correct that we connected the dot. I was looking. I'm looking at my own blog here because I wanted to pull up a name that just. Oh, Jeff Blum.
Okay.
Jeff Blum is the fellow who is the director or CEO or whatever you want to call it of HCAN. Jeffrey Blum, this is a very interesting piece of information, was also a member of Students for a Democratic Society. And as we write in the book, he and Bernadine Dorn at one time shared the same address at an apartment in Chicago. So the connection, again, we cannot get away from Students for a Democratic Society. We cannot get away from Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers. For somebody who just happens to be a neighbor, these people, their names come up endlessly.
Right.
And then another name, of course, that comes up a lot is Heather Booth. And Heather Booth is involved with all of these different organizations. I don't believe I've seen her name connected to Apollo Alliance, but she is connected to all of these other organizations. She is another former Students for a Democratic Society member. Unlike Ayers and Dorn, who went a more activist route, people like Heather Booth or Jeff Blum, they went a route more, Wade Rathke, who was the person who headed up ACORN, I believe he still heads up ACORN, who was another Students for Democratic Society member, they all went to the community organizing route. They went into the more of the boring from within, you know, work within the system to destroy the system. Mm-hmm. She operates the Midwest Academy, which trains community organizers. But she's also an activist. She shows up all over the place, involved all over with all of these different organizations, involved with HCAN. It's just the same suspects all over and over. And it does almost seem monotonous when you keep seeing these names. It's like somebody left a comment. It's like, oh, enough of these people already, you know.
Right.
I'm tired of seeing the same bios and the same connections. And that is maybe a criticism of the book. We identify people who they are over and over. But that's because this is not written like a novel that you start in the beginning and learn the characters.
Right.
And then you know who they are all the way through. You can pick this up at any chapter, and we try to provide enough background information so it holds its own for what you're reading.
Right.
And, yeah, these same people come up over and over. Quentin Young, you know, Robert Creamer, who is one of the people involved with HCAN. Creamer is one of the people who wrote one of the blueprints for the health care bill.
Where did he write it?
Pardon?
Where did he write that?
Well, the blueprint that he wrote while he was in jail for kiting checks.
Hmm.
He helped himself to appropriating a few million dollars. Now, not for personal use.
Right.
This was union money, all involved in a wrapped-up scam of moving the money around, and Creamer got his fingers stuck in the candy jar and got caught.
He got creamed.
He got creamed, and he did time for it. Pardon?
5 months, right?
He did a little while. The whole process dragged out over a long time, and it was still a long time after it happened that he actually went to jail. But, you know, here he writes this new, another blueprint. The progressives, as I have discovered since finishing this book, they come up with a blueprint with every new election, and those will be discussed more in the sequel, which we're working on right now.
That's great. Now, Creamer was Obama's choice to head the Get Out the Vote, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. Creamer was Obama's choice to head up Camp Obama. And Camp Obama was Barack Obama's training camp for his Get Out the Vote organizers. So, you know, it's nice that you have people with these talents that, you know, they don't run stale when they're doing time.
He ends up writing the health plan for the Obama administration, or at least a good chunk of it. Is that what you're saying?
He ends up writing one of the blueprints. As I write in the book, there were at least two or three previous health care plans, or what they felt over a number of years, probably over 20 years. The progressives kept poking around to find the magic formula that was going to work to get them to universal health care.
Right.
So this Creamer's was just one of several different plans, but his was the most recent. I've not compared the plans to the health care bill because, as Nancy Pelosi famously said, we have to pass it before we know what's in it. It's so convoluted. The Congress people who voted for this are still finding out now what is in it, and bit by bit, you know, something comes out all the time. Oh, did you know this is in it? They passed something that basically nobody had read.
Right.
In my mind, I've tried to figure out, how did they compile this thing? We've got, what, 2,000 pages? How do you put together something this massive, yet nobody knows what?
Well, they didn't put it together. The interest groups did, right?
Well, of course they did. It's just like playing a deck of cards. Somebody's got 150 cards, and let's all just toss them out here and shuffle them and hope that we come up with something. And now we have this absolute nightmare that the majority of the voting public or the majority of people polled say, hey, whoa, let's just repeal this. Let's get rid of the whole thing. Yes, there are things in the healthcare system that should be fixed. We know that there are things that aren't perfect. But holy cow, what have we got here? Nobody knows. I mean, even today, I don't think anybody knows what's in there.
This might be the ultimate boring from within to destroy, then. Would it be?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And there are some recent articles out there, and Aaron wrote about this past week in an article, that this can ultimately be, the health care bill can ultimately be what brings everything down.
Right.
Because it is so designed that it touches every facet of life, everything that you can think of in a health care bill reaches out to destroy everything. It's just an absolute monstrosity. And I do hope that somebody gets smart enough to see, you know what, we really should put this on hold and take some time to look at it, because it's going to destroy the private insurance industry, which is exactly what Obama's friend, Dr. Quinton Young, wants. He wants it to be single payer, and people keep missing the point of public health insurance. Public means the government runs it. It's right. Not that it serves the public. It means that the government runs it. If the government runs it, there will be no private companies involved.
I mean, I have to ask this, Brenda. Why would they want to destroy the system? Where would they be then?
That's the thing the Marxists, the socialists, have never figured out. They've never gotten this close before. Socialism and Marxism have failed every time that they have tried in other governments around the world. It has never succeeded. They're getting very close here, but I don't really think that you could ask any one of them what they think is going to be left in the end.
Hmm.
I don't think they've thought that far in advance. And I think the fact that they have been trying to make this work with each presidential election, you know, a new blueprint every 4 years, a new candidate that is going to make it happen. I mean, John Kerry, Jimmy Carter. I mean, look at that. Because we have a lot of candidates that never got that far. They were the ones that they thought were going, you know, over and over and over, you know, Obama's the one we've been waiting for. That didn't come from the progressives. They've been looking for the one for a very, very long time, and they keep thinking they've got the one.
Right.
I'm not sure that they do this time either, because this president tends to backpedal.
Mm-hmm.
He tends to reverse himself a lot. He denies his own words a lot. He'll say something and then, no, I never said that, yet we can show dozens of videotapes where, yes, he did say those
mm-hmm.
things. I don't think that he has the strength to bully through everything that they want.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're getting things become more lukewarm.
What's the future for Obama? Is he a one-term president? How do you think these pieces of legislation unfold?
Well, I know that I follow the socialist website and their different publications, the Communist Party USA website. I follow all of them, as does Trevor from New Zealand. And I watch what they have to say, and I post about their comments quite often. The far left are not happy at all. They expected that Obama was going to be much further to the left than he is. I think that they made him, they can break him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if anybody is going to really take him down, so to speak, but that's not a really good way of looking at it, but if anybody is going to let him fall by not supporting him, it's going to be the far left, because they want more, they're not getting it, and they're in this for generations. They're willing to wait until the right circumstances come along. I think they thought they had it. They fed all of them, whether it's Communist Party USA or the socialists or whatever. They all thought they had their guy. They thought he was the one that was going to deliver. Well, they're still talking hopefully, but they're not sounding very positive. So if you are the king maker, you can be the king breaker. I mean, that's just the way it works. Do I think he's going to get reelected? I think that the midterm election is going to be a pretty good sign. And then watch the left, you know, not the progressives, like the progressive blogs like Daily Kos or places like that. But watch what Communist Party USA, what the Democratic Socialists of America, which is the organization that supports the progressives in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have more than 80 socialists in the House of Representatives. House of Representatives, they're the Democratic Progressive Caucus. They are supported by the Democratic Socialists of America, which is the U.S. branch of the Socialist International.
Mm-hmm.
We have to watch them and see what kinds of things they're saying and doing, because if the unions pull their support, if the Democratic Socialists, the progressives in Congress pull their support, they'll be putting forth a new candidate, because they have done this over and over, election by election. They'll do it again.
Hmm.
The midterms are going to be a pretty good sign how many of them are left in Congress, for one thing.
Right.
Sam Webb of the Communist Party USA said, "We have a friend in the White House." Mm. Well, what happens when that's not your friend anymore? You can't count on your friend in the White House anymore. They're not the ones they're going to stop supporting as much as the progressives in Congress. If the progressives in progressive, just another word for Marxists, they don't like to be called Marxists. They like to call them, first they like liberals, and they decide they didn't like being called liberals. They want to be called progressives. Under it all, they're Marxists. They can call themselves anything they want to. They can keep changing their names. I would watch what they do. What does the Black Congressional Caucus do? What does the Hispanic Congressional Caucus do? And then there's another group, that, and they're pretty much all of the same people, but not 100%. There's another caucus that is called the Out of Iraq Caucus. Right. They're the ones who banded together. They wanted the United States out of Iraq. Well, Iraq is not as big an issue as Afghanistan. So if the left radicals, the old SDSers, and they're still out there and they're still operating to a certain degree, they're not very happy about Afghanistan. I know for sure the Out of Iraq Caucus is not happy about Afghanistan. So got to watch what they all do, because really everything that they really would like to see happen is not happening.
Why do you think that is, that they pretty much put this guy in there? Whose orders is he following then if he's not following their orders?
Well, because they're not the only players. We have the unions. The unions are the big players. Communist Party USA people, they get out there and work to get out the vote.
Okay, but which supporters of his want him to continue to get involved in these wars? Are there any supporters of his then?
Well, of course they are. They're the corporations, because you go and look at the financing, the money that his campaign received to support him. You have three groups. You've got all these progressives, and money-wise, they're the least. Then you have all the unions. They're the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have all the corporations, and there are many special interest groups that they want to, you know, that's another way of talking about them, the special interest groups who poured in tons of money. They've all got an interest in the outcome, and it's a very bad place to be in when you're trying to cater to everybody.
Right.
There's a fourth group.
Okay.
And those are the anonymous people with all the money that flooded in from overseas, foreign contributions that the FEC is, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, never going to look at. Don't know where that money came from. Who poured in all that money? Well, heck, we don't know. And this is where the internet is not such a good thing, because on the Barack Obama campaign website, mm-hmm. people could contribute online.
Right.
Just by filling out, you know, a PayPal or whatever form, and the money went in, ching, ka-ching.
Right.
And who tracked where all that money came from?
Nobody.
Well, heck, we don't know. And nobody can go look, because you just don't have the standing or the authority to go look at that. And nobody is looking at it, even though there have been many blog articles and even some newspaper articles written about where did the money come from. We still don't know. And you know what's going to happen. 2012, the same thing will happen all over again. It didn't get stopped the first time. And again, our old friends, the mainstream media,
yep.
They're not looking.
They're not picking it up. So effectively, the internet's being used to launder money.
You could say that. Mm. You could say that.
Now, Brenda, I noticed that reading your book in its entirety, that many of these people involved, many of these names are Jewish. Am I right, or...
You are right, and that's one of the things that I found fascinating. I don't write about specifically in the book, but I do write about it on the blog. I have an article that's called A Chicago Marxist Family History Mystery, and it starts with a family known as Targ, T-A-R-G, and Bernice Targ Weisbord is connected to Barack Obama's mentor, Frank Marshall Davis. They both taught in a school in Chicago that is known as the Lincoln School. It's a progressive. And when I did a progressive group of people, and when I did a little bit of family history on Targ and the Weisbord, that's what takes me right back to these Marxist families that have their origins as immigrants from Russia, anywhere around the mid to late 1890s. And of course, they were escaping different kinds of purges and whatever going on over there. But it's a common thread, and I have found this with many different Chicago families who were all involved with Marxism. Marxism with socialism in Chicago. And no surprise, I guess, or it was a surprise when I first discovered it, is that they, many of these people, in one way or another, have a connection to Barack Obama. And this Robert Weiss board, as it turned out, was a head of a committee, not only in the 2008 campaign for Obama, but also in his transition team, Robert Weiss board. I mean, these are people now who are prominent in the community. I mean, they're not walking around with red stars or anything on them so that you would know.
Right.
But those connections are there, and it's a common thread, and it was something that I have found is very surprising.
Right.
But then other people who are so knowledgeable about Chicago say, not surprising at all. So, but there's a common thread that you would never probably ever think of.
Right.
It's a very strange thing.
Is that significant at all?
I think it's significant because it shows this continuation of the old school Marxist beliefs that have made their way from Eastern Europe, from Russia, from the Ukraine, or from Prussia, which is the Polish-Russian border. I think that these beliefs have come to this country with the immigrants, and then they've been handed down. They didn't just die when the immigrant families came. They've been handed down to today, and we see those influences now, remarkably connected with the President of the United States.
Right, who's not Jewish. But is it significant that he has that many powerful people around him that are Jews?
I think it's significant. I've seen articles where it is written about, you know, how that he was a favorite candidate or an honored candidate of Jewish backers. Many of them, you know, there are just many of them. David Axelrod, who's one of his White House advisors, you know, many other people around him are Jewish.
Right.
Cass Sunstein, his regulatory czar, you
right.
know, there's just many.
Right. The auto czar, the czar who's going to hand out...
John Bloom.
Ratner, and Kenneth Feinberg. Right, exactly. And, of course, I guess most prominently, you know, many people say the man who created Barack Obama was George Soros.
And right, exactly.
Yeah, so that was something interesting I found from reading your book, that all of the Jewish names, if you remove those names from the book, then you might not have the ties to communists, socialists, and other anti-American extremists, because historically, as you say, Jews have been involved in communism and socialism for centuries.
Yeah, I don't want anybody to think that we assume because someone is Jewish that they automatically have those connections, because one does not necessarily have to go with the other. It's the evidence. It's the, they call it the demographic. If I were to do a demographics, a charting of all of these different people, those would be the factors that would leap out at you. I mean, it's unmistakable.
Nobody's calling you or anybody anti-Semitic because you're pointing out these facts. These are facts, right?
Well, and the facts speak for themselves. This is the body of evidence that we had to work with. And these are the patterns that we found, and they're unmistakable. We didn't go looking for anything to prove a theory. I mean, sometimes people will have a theory, then they go looking for the evidence. This is the evidence.
Right.
We didn't have to go looking for it. It's all over the place.
Amazing. The Manchurian president, Barack Obama's ties to communists, socialists, and other anti-American extremists by Brenda Elliott and Aaron Klein. Brenda, I appreciate all the time you spent with us today. It's a fascinating topic, and of course the book can be purchased at Amazon.com. Let me see. Nope, sorry, there's a one-year wait for the book, Brenda. I'm kidding.
That's possible. I did check it earlier this afternoon, and they said it was in stock.
Yeah.
But you know what? You never know.
You never know. Amazing. A 1 to 4 month wait, and you would think that one of the entities of the mainstream media would want to interview the authors of this book because there's such a clamoring and demand for it, but they didn't see fit to do that. And you said you're working on the sequel to this?
We're working on the sequel. The sequel, I'm not promising a legal paper for anybody to use, but it will be just as tightly researched. For one thing, I'm going to go very deeply into how we got all of this Marxist influence. How did we get this? Because I think people really need to know it. And it's a direct line. I'm going to keep it as simple to understand as possible with lots of resources, hopefully that people will go and read and educate themselves. But it's a very important thing.
When the book does come out, I'd love to get a copy of it, and I'd love to speak with you again. And it's a terrific
Absolutely.
Book. Thank you. It's a terrific book. And thank you for the time. And thank you for doing all that painstaking research and revealing all of these facts that are very important, as you said, for folks to understand. It's always important to read these things, to know what you're dealing with, to know the groups that are behind the scenes pulling the strings. And you certainly did it. And again, I want to thank you so much for your time, Brenda.
Thank you.
Take care.